Before I start, I want to make sure everybody can hear and see me okay. All right, good enough. If at some point that stops being true, just give me a gesture. And I also want to explain our speaking schedule is a little goofy right now because of the Hokyoji retreat. We have a lot of regular MZMC folks, including speakers and priests down in southeastern Minnesota right now at Hokyoji Zen practice community doing a week-long retreat. So the talk I'm going to give to you today, I gave last Tuesday, and the talk that Ben Connolly gave last Sunday, he will give again this Tuesday night. So normally we're on the same week, we give the same talk twice, but because of Hokyoji and because he's down there and I'm up here, we're doing a switcheroo. So that's only relevant if you were here on Tuesday and you're here again today and hoping for something new. I am sorry. So, good morning. This morning, I'm going to talk about this. Some of you have a program in front of you that has on it a Chinese character, the kanji for mu. And so I'm going to talk about the first case in the Gateless Gate koan collection. The first koan in the Gateless Gate, sometimes called the Gateless Barrier. It's a very famous collection of koans. And the koan mu is first. And I guess arguably it's probably the most well-known Zen koan. It's first in the collection because it's the one that would traditionally be the first assigned to you to work with. Soto Zen, our tradition of Zen, doesn't spend a lot of time with koans in a set curriculum the way some schools, Rinzai especially of Zen, do. And yet we still include them. The koan collections are part of our Zen literature, and they're fascinating as a result. It's a fascinating form of literature, and they've been central to Zen practice since the very beginning, and although we work with them a little bit differently in the Soto tradition, at least in my estimation, they're still worth spending time with. They're beautiful, to me at least. They're beautiful expressions of the practice. Koans are sometimes talked about as expressions of an enlightened mind, which is fine. I like expressions of practice better. We don't separate those two things in Soto Zen. And although a lot of koans end with somebody having a big breakthrough, a lot of times they don't. And I like the idea that they're expressions of just the struggle, the human struggle. We call it Zen practice, but we also are aware we're doing something fundamentally very human when we're doing Zen practice, and we're wrestling with the same questions, problems, afflictions that humans have been wrestling with since the very beginning. So I like seeing them that way because it breaks down the barrier between me and my ideas about them. There's this esoteric, weird, ancient Chinese thing. I'm like, no, let's take that away and just talk about them as being humans wrestling with the same thing that I'm wrestling with this morning. So I'm going to talk a little bit about case number one, mu, today. My thoughts are, of course, just my own. One of the things I love about the koan tradition is, at least the way it's been taught to me, it isn't like these are problems that have strict answers or riddles that have specific responses. I think seeing them that way limits their power. So my thoughts about them are just my own, but your relationship with them, your relationship especially with the energy in you that gives rise to the question, that's what's primary. So we'll spend a little bit of time on this today. The first case in the Gateless Barrier, the first koan reads, a monk asked Chao Cho, has the dog Buddha nature or not? And Chao Cho responded, mu. The comment that we are offered from Wu Men, he's the one who compiled this collection of koans many, 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 many years ago, says, for the practice of Zen, it is imperative that you pass through the barrier set up by the ancestral teachers. For subtle realization, it is of the utmost importance that you cut off the mind road. If you do not pass the barrier of the ancestors, if you do not cut off the mind road, then you are still a ghost, clinging to bushes and grasses. So, the monk approaches his teacher and says, does a dog have Buddha nature? And the teacher says, moo. So moo, which is the character that you have today, on your program is usually translated no, no thing, nothing, nothingness, and therefore it can be interpreted, that answer can be interpreted a bunch of different ways. Today I'm going to pretend that the answer is translated as simply as no. I'm going to pretend today that moo just means nope. Nope. No Buddha nature in the dog. Our conversation's done. So Robert Aiken, for some of us that's a familiar name, he's a Western, he's passed now, but he's a Western Zen teacher who spent a lot of time in the koan tradition. In his compilation of koans, in his translation of the Gateless Barrier, he says about this, the oldest meaning of the word barrier in English and in Chinese and in Japanese is checkpoint at a frontier. The oldest meaning of barrier is checkpoint at a frontier. There is only an imaginary mark on the earth to distinguish, say, the United States from Canada, yet our two countries have placed a checkpoint along its length. The barrier is an archetypal element of human growth, an obstacle to be surmounted by heroes and heroines from time immemorial. Down through the ages, there have been countless Buddhas whose barrier turned out to be wide open after all. You too face that barrier. Please confirm it as your own. So, this is a great place to start today. This is a great place to start. Barrier, the way I usually use the word and the way I usually understand the word, is something in my way. It's the reason I can't make progress. There's a barrier, and I oftentimes am very literal in my visualization of what a barrier is. It's a big piece of concrete, right? Or it's a wall, or it is a dead end, or it is a limit, or it is a, I can't get past it because there's a barrier. So to start by looking at the origins of the word the way Aiken Roshi did, it's a checkpoint. There isn't a barrier between the United States and Canada. There's just a checkpoint. There's a threshold. There's a line there. And you may be able to pass, and you may not. But the idea is that it's at least semi-permeable, right? It isn't an end. It's just there is something that has to end here and start here. It's, right? I love that. That's a very, very different emotional response in me. When I see it that way, then barrier meaning end of the road, you're done, turn around, go back. And I'm glad that he used the United States and Canada as his metaphor, although he could have used just about anything. The barrier between the Zendo and the hallway there. Good luck finding it, right? The barrier between the United States and Canada, the barrier between United States and Mexico, the barrier between myself and my beloved, the barrier between the sea and the shore, right? But the reason I'm glad he used that is because I remember the very first time I went to Canada, and I think the only time. I don't know that I've ever been back, but I was just a kid, and we were in northern Minnesota on a camping trip, and I forget what the deal was, but we decided to cross the border. This was a long time ago before there was actual, you needed a passport and all that kind of stuff for the day to go to Ontario, I think. And so when we got there, you know, there's the checkpoint, and back then it was like, oh, you're going in? Great. How long? For a day? Great. Enjoy. That's about how long it took. Pretty low stress. But I was young enough. I must have been pretty young. That when we crossed, I was very disappointed that there wasn't a line on the earth. Because I somehow thought there would be a line on the earth. That flower is a United States flower. And this flower is a Canadian flower. That it was You know, when you're really young, you can't think metaphorically. Everything's very literal, right? This is my side of the seat. That's my sister's side of the seat. And heaven forfend, she should put her paw on my side of the seat, right? This is my toy. This is your toy. How do I be good? How do I be bad, right? We need those barriers. We need those boundaries, we call them, to try to figure out what healthy things look like, right? And as we get older, a little more sophisticated, we start realizing, well, you know, they're more fluid than we think. There's a lot more ambiguity there than we think. And the lines are kind of made up, right? So the line between what I thought was very fixed, the United States, and this thing fixed called Canada was actually arbitrary. Yeah, they made that up a long time ago. They couldn't really figure it out, so they put it there, and it went above that lake and then below that lake, and yeah, they were just making it up. Wow. Wow. So I was very bummed it wasn't a line. There's sort of a sweetness to that, I think. So, sitting with Mu, the very first koan. The reason we call this, and the reason this is introduced to us as a barrier and a checkpoint, is that we are invited, of course, to go past it. So what I have here, I have a visual aid, which I normally don't have. So for those of you listening at home or in the car, I encourage you to do an image search on the internet for the four vows, the four bodhisattva vows. In Chinese, because then you'll see the characters. And they're always written the same way. What we have here is the wall hanging that we normally have over there by the bell on the wall. This is just a scan and a simple print printed on wood from many, many years ago. The scan is of Katagiri Roshi, our founder, his kanji, his lettering. Right? This is his calligraphy for the four vows. So it being written in the traditional style, it is written top to bottom, and right to left. So here is the first vow. Beings are numberless, vowing to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Here we have Dharma gates, boundless, vowing to enter them. See, that's gate. Isn't that cool? It actually looks like a gate, right? And then finally, here we have Buddha's way. Buddhism is unsurpassable, unattainable, right? And our vow to become it. That's Buddha. That's Dao, or way, path, Buddha Dao. And here's what we have, the third character, all the way across. Mu, 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 Mu. That's how far you're going to get. You have to stop. There's a gate there. There's a fence there. It's drawn right across the heart of the vows. This is how far you're going to get. That's when you have to face Mu. That's, right? Beings are numberless. Now what? What are you going to do? What are you going to do with numberless suffering beings? How are you going to respond to that? You can't attain Buddhism. What are you going to do? Your opportunities, your ability to delude yourself, inexhaustible. What are you going to do? You'll never attain Buddhism. You can't. What are you going to do? Isn't that interesting? It's written right across the page. There's a gate, barrier, right written into the heart of the tradition itself. And these are the vows. So already, we know, this is our response to Mu. This is our response. What arises in the human heart when we are faced with an infinite number of suffering beings? The response from the personality is, don't do anything. It's an undoable job. Any project manager will tell you, if the job is undoable, you do not start it. Right? I'd really love to build a bridge across that expanse, but it's way, way, way too far. So we wouldn't start. We don't like attempting the impossible. Right? That's a very ego-driven response. Oh, it's not possible. I won't bother to do it. Why? Well, I don't want to fail. I don't want to waste my time, right? I'm scared of having a feeling. I'm scared of feeling ashamed. I don't want to waste my time. And so the four vows, our response, is completely counterintuitive. Well, there's infinite need? Well, I'll just meet it with infinite love. I'll just meet it with infinite compassion. That's what it needs. It's inconceivable. So what? So of course it's inconceivable. Who cares? Lots of things are inconceivable. Doesn't mean they're impossible. I'll do it anyway. And we think of these vows in Buddhism as being, you know, lofty. This is the heart of the whole tradition for us. And when we do initiation, we just did initiation here a few weeks ago. We take these vows. When an ordination happens, we take these vows. During formal and informal services, including today, at the end of this talk, we will put our palms together and chant, "Beings are numberless." We'll say them today, out loud. Those very vows, we will say them. And yet, I don't think that something that lofty is unique to Buddhists. I don't think it's a special Zen thing. I don't even think it's necessarily something we have to frame as high or even aspirational or even spiritual. I think humans do this kind of stuff all the time. All the time. Some part of us knows, you know, the house I'm living in will someday not exist. It won't. I mean, everybody knows that. But I'm still going to fix it up. I'm going to take really good care of it. I know my marriage is going to end. It has to. One of us is going to die sooner or later. I'm still going to do my very, 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 very best today. Love that person, see them, to be with their suffering, to hold them, right? I'm going to do it anyway. You know, when your kid is born, you know they're going to die someday. You know they're going to suffer. You know they're going to get bullied. You know they're going to misunderstand. You know they're going to skin their knee. You know they're going to have their hearts broken. You know they're going to, right? And you just do it anyway. You just do it anyway. Don't you? You just do it anyway. In fact, when they're born, you celebrate. It's outrageous. You celebrate. Wow. And when people get married, you celebrate. That's like the best thing ever. Even though you know, oh, sooner or later, you won't be. One of you is either going to get a divorce or you're going to die. And yet we're still like, woo! We're going to totally party because the power of that, it's just written right into our consciousness. We're going to do it anyway. We're going to do it anyway. We're going to do it anyway. Isn't that wild? We do know, don't we? On some level, this whole human thing is just a game. It'll be over soon. Whether soon is 1,000 years or 10,000 years or 1,000,000 years, it's going, going, gone. It's a dream. And yet we still just, wow, we just try as best we can. We just try so hard. We go up to mu and through it, past it. So here's how I think this shows up for us in our actual actual practice. And this is what I want to spend more time on today. I called this talk Facing the Wall. Because mu is the wall, mu is the barrier, mu is the limit, mu is the thing you can't get past until you can. Facing the wall. But we spend a huge amount of time literally and a huge amount of time, obviously metaphorically, facing the wall in Zen practice. You could argue this is facing the wall practice. This is what we do. The literal dimension is hard to envision today because this is a Sunday, and here at Zen Center on Sunday we have a large group, and we don't have the wall space to all face the wall, so we face in. We've got chairs there and cushions, and we all face in, and it feels nice. It's more communal. But if you come here tomorrow morning for Zazen, or any morning for Zazen other than this one, the room is set up in an entirely different way, and all the cushions just trace the perimeter here of the room, and we sit on our cushion, and we face the wall. Despite the fact we're leaving our eyes open during meditation, we face the wall. Kind of weird. First time I came here, I thought they must be being punished for something. They've been very bad monks. And they're just being punished. And then I learned, no, this is actually what they do. Wow, we face the wall. Why? Well, a bunch of reasons why. Supposedly, I don't know how many of these are made up. The first version I heard was, that's to honor Bodhidharma. He's the creator of Zen, the inventor of Zen, the great first patriarch, and he, according to the story, faced the wall for 9 years. He's in a cave. He meditates in a cave. He faces the wall for 9 years. So we honor Bodhidharma by facing the wall. Second reason is because it's a sign of trust. It's a sign of faith. Buddha is protecting us from behind. I can therefore feel okay facing the wall. Right? Remember the old Westerns, like if I'm a gunfighter and I don't trust anybody, then I want to sit with my back to the wall and face the door, right? That way I can keep track of who's coming and going, right? We call that vigilance, 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 right? I'm fearful. I'm living a fearful existence. I want to make sure I'm going to be safe. I want to see who's coming in and out. So we do the opposite. No, you don't. You turn your back to the door and you face the wall. You're completely vulnerable. Isn't that interesting? It's a stance of the heart, isn't it? A state of the heart, vulnerability, a chosen position of vulnerability to experience. Whatever comes up, I'll face it. I won't run. I'll face it. All right? And of course, practically speaking, I experience facing the wall as it just works really well because our eyes are half open. The field of vision is unobscured. I don't have a lot of people in my field of vision or objects or things moving. This is less distracting. Right? I still have light coming in, but I've got a nice wall to look at. And I know everybody in this room who has done Zazen for any length of time whatsoever facing the wall knows that after a while it's just a mirror. It just shows you what's inside you. The wall gets very boring. Oh, I must be boring. The wall gets very interesting. Ooh, I'm interesting. But it's all just your mind. I mean, you just watch how you create the story on the wall. Right? So we face the wall. Katagiri Roshi asked us, if this were your last moment on earth, how would you sit? So that's Mu. Sometimes the Buddha's Bodhi seat, the seat he takes when he's under the tree, is described as him facing his Mu. I have looked and I have searched and I have tried and I have failed for 6 years. I've done this impossible thing. I keep looking for the end. I keep looking for the solution. I keep looking for the salvation. And I can't find it. And I can't find it. And I can't find it. I'm utterly defeated. I will finally sit down under a tree. I give up. I will not move until I wake up or die. That's facing Mu directly. And he faces the three temptations of desire, fear, and shame, and he faces his Mu. And at some point in our practice, and for some folks, this is what brings you in the door, and so it's very familiar to you. It's the very beginning of your practice. For others of you, this doesn't show up for quite a while. The heart and the mind have a way of peeling themselves, and the thing that brought you in the door stops being quite so important, and a couple years into your practice, you're dealing with something in your heart that's much deeper than that, and after a few more years, it finally shows up, the biggie. So I don't know what that is for you. It's different for everybody. But at some point in our practice, Zazen is about facing the wall, facing ourselves, facing the void, nothingness, no-thing-ness, facing the big no, our Mu, our Mu. And this is a very solitary place. We do this alone. One of the other reasons we sit facing the wall is so we can sit alone together. I'm sitting with you. I'm sitting next to you. Maybe all week I'm breathing next to you. But I'm alone. I'm alone. I'm facing the wall. So there's a fascinating paradox there. You guys know this who have done Zazen in a group. You're aware you're doing it together. You're getting all this support. You're surrounded by other beings who are sitting up straight, just like Buddha, just like you. And yet you know it's you. It's just you. You know, it's just you, that affliction that's coming up. It's just you, 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 you. So our response is keep our seat. We keep our seat. In the face of Mu, in the face of the wall, in the face of the barrier, we keep our seat. And there's the counterintuitive dimension that I love so much about Buddhism. When a barrier shows up, when suffering shows up, when adversity, difficulty, affliction, when they show up, we turn toward them. We turn toward them. We get closer to them. We investigate them. We hold them. We listen. We look. We go in. We go in. We don't do what we normally do, is turn around and go the other way. Or distract, or deny, or repress, or blah, 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 blah. We investigate. We go closer to. Keep your seat. That's Pema. You guys know Pema Chodron, most of you, I'm assuming? That's one of her great repeated lines, keep your seat. But if I know, keep your seat. The solution isn't elsewhere. You have to keep your seat. You have to keep your seat. It takes a long time, I think, for me anyway, to develop the kind of stability of practice to be able to stay with affliction without running, covering, distracting, avoiding, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. To really keep my seat. Very, very challenging. So there is a big Mu there. There is a big barrier there. There's a big something there that at some point we are asked to face in our practice. And I do not know what that is for you. It may have words. It may not. I remember once Tim giving a talk about many, many, many years ago doing morning Zazen, every morning sitting over there in that seat, facing the wall very shortly after his brother's suicide, and just being, just every day, rage. Every day, rage. Every day, rage. Every day, heartbreak. Every day, heartbreak. Just sitting in it. Just sitting in it. Sitting in it. sitting in it, feeling it, observing it, holding it, wanting to run, not running, wanting to run, running for a little while, catching himself, coming back, right? Anger, heartbreak. Just he's grieving. This is the grief process. He's sitting inside of his grief. I'm coming back. He was coming back over and over to over and over to one of his huge moves. One of the huge moves of his life. One of the huge, right? And it is universal. It is universal. It's sometimes, at least in Western psychology, it's talked about as the very first thing that happens to you when you're born. Wah! There it is. Right? Because already there's a moo. Nope, you can't stay inside mom anymore where you're forever cared for and you're warm and safe. You can't. Sorry. It's cold out here. And it's dangerous and it's prickly and it's very bright. And very soon you're going to figure out that you're separate. And then you're going to be really scared because you've got a self to protect. And then you're going to get really greedy and try to hang on to stuff to protect the self. And then you're going to get really... That's just what's going to happen. It's just universal. Don't worry, you're in good company. 7.5 billion others that are alive right now doing the very, very same thing, but I'm sorry, you can't stay there. And then you get a little bit older, and you do feel that separation between yourself and your mom or your parent, and there's a moo, barrier. And then you get a little bit older, and it dawns on you, oh my God, I'm going to die. Yeah, you're going to die. I'm sorry. No, you can't stay with her. No, you can't live forever. No, you can't be comfortable all the time. No, you cannot always have a full stomach. No, you cannot always be just the right temperature. No, you can't always be around people that you love and never around people that you hate. No, you... No, no, no. Does your life ever just feel sometimes like just nothing but no's? Do you know that? It's like, wow, are there any yeses folded in there? Any? I mean, because it really is. Ah. Ah. Sitting with those. I can't always be comfortable. I can't always be with those I love. I can't live forever. I can't see them. I can't always be safe. I can't, you know. And these are the big moves. We're not, and the koan, our invitation here is not to investigate the little kind of cultural ones, like, no, you can't marry a Catholic if you're a Protestant. Or no, you can't cross against a red light. Or no, you can't go above 55 miles an hour. Not those. These are the biggies, right? The biggies. Dukkha. C.G. Jung has a great definition for dukkha, and he does not in any way equate those. This is just me. But he says, he calls it this type of suffering as the legitimate pain of being human. Isn't that nice? The legitimate pain of being human. That's a great definition. To me, that's a great definition of dukkha, our first noble truth. Legitimate. I love the word legitimate. It just makes me feel better. But this isn't like, oh, everybody has such an easy time of it except for you, Busho. Are you slow? What's your deal? Your pain is illegitimate. You have no right to it. You're suffering because you're messing up. You're screwing it up. You're not doing it right. The person sitting next to you, they're doing just fine. What's wrong with you? The legitimate pain of being human, we inherit it. So, the other way of talking about Mu a little bit to extend this natural human suffering thing are the five remembrances. That's what we call them in Buddhism. Which is the reality, the unavoidable truth of sickness, old age, death, and separation. You know, at some point those things dawn on us in a very deep way. I will get old. I will get sick. I will die. I will be separated from everyone and everything that I love. That's inevitable. There is not a force in the universe that will prevent those things from happening. Maybe that's Mu for you. Maybe that's Mu. Mu makes us ask the biggest possible questions about our existence. And Norm Fisher, the contemporary Zen teacher, he's one of my faves, he says the only reason we have religion is because we die. That's why we have religion, because we die. And I guess another way of saying that would be, if I want to paraphrase, is the only reason we have religion is because of Mu. There's a thing called Mu. There's a thing called a barrier. There's a thing called an edge, a boundary, something you can't get past. There's an affliction. There's something underneath there. It's existential, we would call it in the West, our existential crisis, right? That's why we have these things. That's why we have cultures that reference the absolute. We call them religion. Right? An actual culture that's designed to address and deal with these fundamental things that go beyond, you know, flat tires and unpaid mortgage bills, that go to the big thing, the truth, the actual truth of my sickness and old age and death and separation and all the questions that those truths give birth to in me, that's what religion does, or spirituality, if you prefer that term. And at some point, the path that we walk becomes a barrier itself. In the mystical Christian tradition, they say the last barrier to God is God. You got to get rid of that before you can actually get there. And in Zen, we'd say the last barrier to Zen is Zen. We say that a lot. A lot of koans are about, you have got to go beyond Buddha. You have got to pitch that whole Zen thing you're caught up on. That is totally a limitation to you now, right? If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. You're up against it again. Oh, there you go again, trying to fit into this little box. There's your moo. You're not. You've got to go beyond that. You've got to go beyond that. You've got to go beyond that. So when we are facing moo, when we are facing our own barrier, our own voidness, it is an intensely personal practice. We know that I am the one who creates my own greed. I am the one who creates my own delusion. I am the one who creates my own anger. I am the one who creates my own. I am the one. I am the one. I am the one. And at the same time, I am aware that this is fundamental to the human condition. And the shape mine takes, of course, is unique to me. Fine. But there's nothing, in a sense, personal about it. It's entirely the question, the moo. There is only the one moo. And so we do sit together to face it, and we do support one another in facing it. And the degree to which I am able to stay with it starts mattering, or starts depending less on my own willpower and my own personal integrity and courage, and starts being more about the force of the millions who have walked this path before me, the millions who are asking the same question now, the millions who will come after me. I start being aware that the process that I'm engaged with is a transpersonal, universal process, right? This is the moo, and I am one who is sitting with it. So I think there's support in that. It's one of the reasons Sangha is so important for us, that we're alone. Of course we're alone, and yet we're not. So here's the reason I love the answer to the question so much. It's a great koan. It really is a great koan. Does even a dog have Buddha nature? Nope. The reason that answer is so nice is because it's a lie. Right? Of course the dog has Buddha nature. Dork. Everybody knows that. It's the party line in Mahayana Buddhism. It's been the party line in Mahayana Buddhism since 100 BC or whatever. Everything not only has Buddha nature, in Soto Zen we say everything is Buddha nature. So does even a dog? Well, the reason he's using dog is because in that time, in that culture, dogs were the lowest possible thing. Lowest possible thing. They're like cockroaches. It'd be like us saying, do even cockroaches have Buddha nature? Right? I like to imagine when I inhabit a koan the way this one invites us to. It sort of seems like the shorter the koan, the more our imagination is invited in. This tells us so little that we're almost having to use our imagination to flesh it out a little bit. I like to imagine, just because this is the kind of stuff that works for me, that this isn't just an anonymous monk and an anonymous teacher who have never yet met and he's asking clever Zen question. I like to imagine that they are in relationship with one another and that the teacher knows his heart quite well, this monk. And that he's actually not asking a question about the cosmology of Mahayana Buddhism and the nature of Buddha nature, because that's a very conceptual question. It's a fine question. I mean, yep, we get to ask that. Good, ask it. But, you know, Dokusan settings, formal interview settings, and we don't know what setting this takes place in, but I like to imagine it's in a formal setting. I want to bring a heart thing. I want to bring a heart question. I want to bring whatever's afflicting me most, whatever hurts the most. I'm going to see the doctor, essentially. And I want to bring what's hurting. I don't want to bring a mental question so much. I really want to bring, right? And so does even a dog? You can feel it, can't you? He's asking about himself. He's asking about himself. He's trying to find, does this teaching that you guys have, this whole, like, everything has Buddha, is there a loophole? Is there an escape route? Because I'm probably pretty sure that would be me. Right? What I love about this koan is it's giving words to what every one of us does at some point, right? If you're a Zen student and your teacher looks at you and says, you're Buddha, you immediately think, oh, you think that I am Buddha. And people like you are Buddha. And even if I'm in a really, really, really good place, I might be able to stretch my heart mind big enough to go, oh, look at everybody, they're all around me, look at all the Buddhas except me. We can't, we have such a hard time including ourselves. We have such a hard time, right? Because we're so fundamentally driven by the idea of separation. There's the universe and there's me. Just two things. There's always two things, right? We got a binary machine in our brain, and when we're up there, there's always two things. There's perpetually two things. There's the universe, and there's you. And maybe it's a good universe full of potential Buddhas who are just wisdom and compassion embodied, waiting to happen. Wow, that's a pretty awesome universe. And I'm the bump. I'm the separate thing. We so believe in our separation. Mu is the fundamental barrier, the fundamental misunderstanding, the fundamental delusion of separateness, that you are separate, that you are separate, you are separate, you are separate, right? And ideas like everything has Buddha nature really shows us our separation, because we immediately go, well, it doesn't sound like my life. I'm a hot mess, right? My relationship aren't right. My bills are unpaid, and I'm kind of cranky. My back sort of hurts. I really need more exercise. Ah. Right? I mean, I'm just... Wow. So his teacher is doing this wonderful, wonderful thing, the way I imagine this conversation, because his student is coming to him and going, even me? I mean, really, even me? He wants him to throw him a rope. Me too? Do I get to? Me? You can tell he's struggling, right? He is asking the existential question. Do I matter? Am I included? I mean, seriously, that is the only question. Is this whole thing around me part of me? Is this do I matter? Is anything here worth doing? What is this, right? And his teacher does the most fantastic bit of kung fu compassion I can think of, because he says, nope. He won't take away the student's mu. And the student wants him to take away the mu. Please take away this mu. And the teacher's wise enough to go, no, if I just do that, then you're going to grab onto that answer. You're going to grab onto me, and that's not it. And me telling you that? You already know it. You already have it in your head. You already have the teaching. Everything has got Buddha nature. Then why are you asking me? You already know it. And I can see that it's not taking away your suffering. I can see that there's a suffering being in front of me. So I will instead give you the mirror. So often, the mu is a mirror. Right? The really good teacher just shows you a mirror. That's all they ever really do. Here you go. Here you go. Here it is. Here's you. Here's you. Here's you. It's all made up, this whole barrier. Yeah, believe in it as much as you want. Just so you know, it's just the wall in Zazen. That whole monster you made up was made up. The whole thing you made up was just made up. It's you, you, you. So he takes away the opportunity for this student, for this monk, to distract himself again, delay it again, go up into his head again. He's trying to sneak away. It's like, no, you don't. No, 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 no. You have to keep facing the wall. There's another version of this koan. I don't know where it comes from. But the other version is just kind of fleshed out a little, where the student goes to the teacher, oh, does everything... Oh, I've been told that everything has Buddha nature. Does that include me as well? And the teacher says, nope. How come? Because you asked that question. You're not... You're still not there. You're still not there. The neat thing about the teacher is we trust that they understand the student is already there. We trust that the teacher doesn't think, wow, you idiot, you're not figuring it out. We trust that the teacher actually knows this is Buddha inquiring Buddha about Buddha. And yet something in their heart hasn't quite shifted yet. So they're just on the edge, right? Right? They need that fire and that support and that certainty that comes from within based on their actual experience of non-separateness. Right? When we hear, oh, you aren't separate, that does not give us an experience of non-separateness. It gives us an idea, which is fine. But you've all been told that 1,000 times if you've been hanging out here. Oh, you were a Buddha. You're not separate. Like, yeah, that's cool. I love that idea. Oh, I'm suffering. Oh, okay, well, then you're still stuck. Wow. We need to be reminded of this over and over and over. So he's starting by just saying, nope, you need to know you're still caught. So when Zen asks us other questions, like what was your face before your grandparents were born, that's a mu question. Show me your face before your grandparents were born. Well, that's a ridiculous question. I wasn't around then. Oh, there's your limit. There's the place where you think you end. You have an idea in your head that you were born the day that you were born, and you die the day that you die, and that that is the limits of you, and that you are somehow limited by those two things. Those are your two barriers. That's what you imagine to be true. I'm asking you a question that, by definition, denies that entirely. What was your face 1,000 years ago? What is your face? What is, in present tense, what is your face 1,000 years from now? Show me that. What is your face long after the earth has spiraled into the sun and the thing called human is long since gone? Show me your face now. Show me your Big Bang face. Show me 1,000 years before your Big Bang, right? Show me that. We're always like, the teacher's job is like, where's the limit you imagine that you have? I want to bring you up against that so you can crack through it and you can understand that you are not, in fact, limited in that way. Right? So, one of my very first heroes, Harriet Tubman. One of my very first heroes is Harriet Tubman. And she said, I freed 1,000 slaves. I could have freed 1,000 more if only they knew they were slaves. I think about that a lot. If only they knew. The teacher is refusing to let the student believe that they're not a slave. In that moment, that student is still caught. They need to still be caught. You need to understand your own limits and how you are creating them and how much suffering that causes you. Now you have fuel. Now you have something you want to work with, right? Right? Part of the teacher's job is to show you the imagined barrier. Of course it's imagined, but them telling you it's imagined isn't going to help you. You need to understand you're still caught. Then you have motivation to actually get free. Can you do that? Of course you can. But me giving you stuff like, oh, but you're free already. Mm-mm. Yeah, that's true, but not yet. Not for your heart. You're still suffering. So in the Zen path, we end up finding freedom by first recognizing that we're in prison. We have to. We have to. We have to. We have to see Mu over and over and over and over. And then eventually the spell is broken. And we realize, no, we're not in prison. We never were. But we can't skip those two things, right? And what I see more than anything else when I'm working with people one-to-one is they show up as suffering and they want to go to a place called freedom or enlightenment or contentment or I don't know what. I don't know what. It's the thing that motivated me for a long time. And Zen is their way to get there. But what they don't want to do is that middle part of investigating the prison. I want to use Zazen as a way of doing an end run around my suffering. I do not want to face Mu. I do not want to face the wall. I do not want to do what Tim did and sit inside of my grief for several years. What he did is he healed his grief. What we want to do is not actually heal our grief. We want to leave our grief and avoid our grief and cover our grief and distract ourselves from our grief and want it to be healed, but we don't want to have to sit inside it. We don't want to have to do that. Nobody wants to face their Mu. Of course not. We're humans, right? We instinctively turn away from suffering. And Buddhism does this crazy thing. Nope, turn back around again. Turn back around again. Please investigate that suffering. Please move closer to it. Please pick it up and hold it. Please inquire about it. Please comfort it. Are you sad? Be sad. Don't have any separation between you and sad. Are you heartbroken? Go into heartbreak. Be with heartbroken and have there no separation between you and heartbroken. Right? We want freedom, and yet we always turn the wrong way. So this teacher, this Mu, is just gently turning this student around one more time. Right? Gently turning them around one more time. Nope, not you. Nope, no Buddha nature there. Right? Force him to sit with it. He has to sit inside the prison before he realizes there isn't a prison. So what we do in Zen is we go all the way into our suffering. We go all the way in. All the way in. All the way in. We go all the way into our suffering and then we come up in the suffering of others. It's the door to compassion. To go down into my suffering and I come up in yours. I go so deep into your suffering, I come up in mine. It's the suffering. There isn't a separation. That's the great solvent of Mahayana Buddhism is that suffering is transformed by being with it. Being with it. That's the thing. That's the fundamental human experience. It's difficulty, suffering, resistance, Mu, right? That's the fundamental human experience. And so it's the reason we can connect. The only reason I can even have a conversation with you is because you've suffered. So have I. There's the thing. There's the thing. Wow. there's the thing. We've both experienced heartbreak. We've both experienced separation. We've both experienced loss. We've both experienced greed. We've both experienced hate. We've both experienced all the poisons, all the delusions. Wow, it's hard to be a human. Yes, it is. Take my hand. We are not separate from one another. This very experience can be the thing that brings us together. Right? Have you noticed that? That like the kind of connections you make at a cocktail party are different than the kind of connections you make in a support group? When we come together inside of our suffering, we come together in a really deep way, a fundamentally human way that goes way deeper than our personalities and our preferences. And I love my sci-fi club. We can all get together and talk about how much we love Doctor Who. That's really, really cool. Yes, that's socialization. That's important, and I get to do that. But when I go to my AA meeting, there's a whole nother thing going on there. We are not one because we both have the same preferences. We're one because we both ache and we suffer. Right? Wow, there's a deep connection. That's what Sangha is. When people come to Zen Center, on some level, whether they are aware of it yet or not, they are here in this room facing the wall because they have Mu, because they suffer, because it's hard. And we sit with each other because we trust that being with that has a liberative potential. That's the doorway to our freedom. That's the doorway. It shows up as no, 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 until it doesn't, and then it's yes. And it's always been yes, and there is only yes. And you are yes, born from yes, on top of yes, inside of yes. There's never, ever, ever been anything other than yes. And yet I have to sit with no long enough to understand what that means. Right? We know what we are by getting familiar with what we're not. We know things by contrast. So I got to wrap up here. Charlotte Joko Beck, we lost her a couple years ago. She's a brilliant contemporary Zen teacher, says, "Our practice must be careful, meticulous, and patient. We must face everything." So, I have an idea that you already know what your Mu is. And if you don't, that's fine. It might not have words to it. But it's been with you your whole life. It's been with you way before you were born. It will be with you 1,000 years from now. And it is a door to walk through. It is a threshold to pass. It is an opportunity to become more, bigger, freer, deeper, wider. It is the doorway of compassion. It is the doorway of wisdom. It is what connects you to others. It is what connects you to yourself. So please do what you're already doing. Be very patient because you're already patient. Please be very fierce. Be very courageous. You are already fierce and courageous. You wouldn't be here if you were not. You have those two things. Be very patient. Be very courageous. Keep doing that. Bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. And that's what we do. So I invite you, please, please keep facing the wall. Please keep sitting with your Mu. Please keep sitting with it. There's a huge yes there, and it's just waiting for you. Thank you very much. I rambled a bit. We probably have time for a question or two, perhaps. If anybody has anything they'd like to offer or ask. Oh, Benton, please.
You know, there's another painting of Mu by Katagiri right here. That one.
Yep.
That one's marvelous.
Yep. We have lots of calligraphic representations of Mu. It's not unusual for Mu to be in a Zendo. Usually symbols. You don't have a lot of symbols, written symbols in a Zendo because they're scattering of the mind. So we have symbols like the ones behind me on the altar. If there is calligraphy in a Zendo, at least in Japanese Soto Zen, it's generally a calligraphy of Mu. So what you have there is the same thing as what we have here, just stylized. Roughly, this would be like the kind of printing you learn when you're in first grade, and that would be like calligraphy if you're a PhD. Same word, but you've gotten really good at writing it. So yeah, if you have a chance later, check out Katagiri Roshi's Mu. His isn't as important as yours, but it's also the same as yours. Christine.
Thoughts, you know, talking about that internal delusion of separation. When within the larger world, there are these sort of reified delusions of separation that end up with people being treated differently or different. You know, how can you speak at all to that kind of in the context of this?
Oh, it's such a good question. And I don't have any right answers. I'll be quick here because of the time, but the way I've come to understand this is that in my own practice on the cushion, I basically do mindful That is to say, kind. Mindful and kind attention to body and breath and emotions. When affliction arises, anger arises, greed arises, hate arises, heartbreak, where is it? There you are, I see you, I'm with you kindly. Right? And Zazen also introduces an element of samadhi, a non-dual meditation. Right? We observe body and breath until they disappear, or the line between self and the thing that's witnessing, being witnessed, dissolves, breather and breath until there's just the one thing. And what I think that does, at least for me, is it increases my capacity to see others as not separate. So practically speaking, how that shows up day to day, almost never is it helpful for me to notice a circumstance in which I'm really, really activated and angry by other. Because this is pretty much waking life, right? Other, oh my God, you're so stupid, you're wrong. I do like to remind myself, oh, I'm imagining that you're whatever. But what I tend to do then is I go down into the suffering. I notice that I am angry, and I recognize that my experience of anger is based on being hurt and being scared, and that you're hurt and scared too. So it gives me a chance, when I'm speaking with you, whom I am angry at, to understand, actually, on some level, we're starting from the same place. And you have a tactic called this to take care of that feeling, and I might have a tactic called this to deal with that feeling, but actually underneath, we're both really freaked out and hurt. That's what's underneath anger. So me knowing that helps me to choose things like right action, right speech, to try to. Does it always show up as just like complete, perfect compassion? No. No. That's part of my moo. In another 50 years, perhaps. But I actually know very few people. There's a handful of people who can actually meet that with great equanimity. But I also don't think equanimity excludes feelings, too. I think you can be equanimous with anger. You can be equanimous with heartbreak. You can be equanimous with... So I don't know if that's in any way helpful. It's such a relevant question because we don't want this stuff to get too abstract. I mean, it has to be like, where is this helpful for me later on the freeway with coworker at the peace march at something? You know, where does this show up? And the intellectual knowing you're not separate from me, it's helpful to an extent, but when the war is still going on inside this heart, then the war is going on outside of this heart too. So the practice on the cushion becomes really important for me, just as important as the practice off, I think. Thank you. I wish there was more we could do with that today. Anyway. Thank you. I will turn things over to our Dawn, Deb.